Today is September 16th, 2017. This is Tony Herman interviewing John Richley concerning his service for our country. Which branch of the service did you serve in?
Army.
Army? Were you enlisted or did you get drafted?
Neither. ROTC, so commissioned.
ROTC and commissioned, okay. Did you fight in a war?
Vietnam.
Vietnam. Where did you, after ROTC, where did you do your training?
Excuse me. I was commissioned a cavalry officer in 1962, so my first duty assignment was the basic course at Fort Knox, Kentucky. And then I'd even studied German in college. I was the only ROTC cadet in the business school who took a foreign language as an elective instead of zoology. Everybody else took that. But my plan was I will impress the people in the Pentagon who assign officers, and if I take German, then I'll go to Germany. And I took German, got my orders, and was not able to use a lot of my German in my year in Korea. That was my initial assignment in a cavalry unit. Actually enjoyed it so much that when I left, I volunteered. I was a two-year person at the time, and I signed the paperwork to voluntarily extend, and I spent the next 20 years as an Army officer.
Okay, what rank did you attain?
Major.
Major. So you did fight in Vietnam. What was that like?
Very interesting. I had served a year in Korea. I had served a year on the east-west German border in Germany, which I liked very much and could use my German, although I'd forgotten it all by then. And a couple of years in training assignments back in the States, and was a basic training company commander at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, that was very challenging, and got orders about halfway through my year for Vietnam. Felt I was ready for it, so I was a senior captain by then, and had to go to jungle school in Panama for 2 weeks. The only good thing, well, two good things about it. One, it kind of acclimatized me for Vietnam, and two, it gave me credit for 2 weeks in Vietnam. So I, instead of a whole year, I was there. We who went to jungle school were there for 11 and a half weeks. I have been a military collector for years and years, and when we got to jungle school, the first day, they bussed us out to the training area, and already there was a group of about 20, I guess, appeared to be Americans, a lot of blonde Caucasians, but they had on uniforms, but they were not the Army fatigue uniform, which at that time was dark green. Special units had camouflage. These had a camouflage pattern that I was totally not familiar with. They were already there on one side of the bleachers. And being curious and a collector, I asked one of the sergeants what country they were from. And he said, "America, sir." And I said, "Well, that's not the Army uniform." He said, "They're not in the Army, they're in the Navy." I said, "What in the world are Navy guys doing in a camouflage uniform in jungle school?" He said, "They are what's called a SEAL team," which I had heard of. The SEALs had only been organized 5 years before. This was 1967. So I was really itching to get to know a SEAL, but I didn't get to know them. They were very clannish. They wanted nothing to do with us Army guys. So I didn't get to know them, but I was mightily impressed by them. Hoped to see some in Vietnam, but I never did. And ironically, every one of them had been to jungle school at least once. And what they did was, between missions to Vietnam, which for them were only 6 months, they would be sent to a school somewhere. So as a team, they all... The timing worked out that they would come back, and about half of them had been to jungle school. All of them had been to Vietnam, so why in the world they were back in jungle school, I don't know. But I was very impressed with them and hoped to meet some, but did not. Then went to Vietnam and was in a cavalry squadron from November 67 to November 68. And for those who know their chronological history of Vietnam, the last day of January 68 was what began the week-long Tet Offensive, and our squadron was right in the middle of that for the whole week, and that was interesting and exciting. And then, after Tet, we were the cavalry squadron for the 9th Infantry Division that was being moved deep into the Delta. It was the Delta Division. And we could have operated only on the road network. And General Abrams was the deputy at the time to General Westmoreland, and he looked on a situation map, and there was no Army armor, no tanks, north of Hue. And he felt there should be. And since we could not have operated deep in the Delta, he convinced Westmoreland to cut our squadron loose and send us by LST to Da Nang. And ultimately, within a month, we were operating on the DMZ. That was Marine territory at the time. So we were attached to a Marine division. So if the Marines had had combat patches from Vietnam, I would likely have worn one the rest of my career, because I spent more time with the Marines than I did the Army. We were the first Army element to go into the DMZ and to fire, direct fire across it. And it was an interesting time. And then we began to, we were replaced by an Army mechanized brigade and began moving our way back south. And that was when I left in November of 68.
Now, most people that don't have military experience would think of the cavalry as being horses.
Yeah.
And obviously, you guys weren't riding horses through the jungle.
The Army traded horses in 1942, before we actually entered World War II offensively, and traded them in for jeeps. So cavalry means reconnaissance and security. Whatever we were in, and we had three types of vehicles, jeeps for the officers and scouts, armored personnel carriers that carried an infantry squad of 11 men and M48 tanks at the time. So we were the smallest, what's called combined arms. We had artillery, we had mortar squad. We had artillery, we had tanks, we had infantry, and we had scouts. And each division, armor or infantry, is assigned one cavalry ground squadron. There's also an air cavalry that's all helicopters. Now, we had a helicopter troop that flew reconnaissance for us, but not for anybody else. And so we were the eyes and ears of whatever senior commander we were attached to. And once we were attached to a Marine division, we became, and the Marines don't have cavalry, we became the eyes and ears of that Marine general's division and fed him intelligence and so forth.
So you were a fairly mobile unit.
Absolutely mobile.
So not tied down to a particular base for any length of time.
We had a base camp, obviously. Excuse me. All units did. Oh, thank you. Yeah. But no, we had three line troops, each commanded by a captain, and they would come into base camp only rarely for maintenance. And otherwise, they operated and lived in the field, in Indian territory, so to speak.
Did you have any interaction with the locals?
Absolutely did. We had all sorts of, we had one interpreter for the whole squadron, and my first 6 months, well, my whole year, I was in what's called headquarters troop, which I didn't, that was not my preference, but my first 6 months, I was the commander of headquarters troop. So I had all the cooks and mechanics and medics and so forth, rather than the fighting cavalrymen. And then at the end of 6 months, all captains were switched. And since I had had my command, I had to go to a staff position. And the only one coming open when it was time for me was what's called S4, or the supply officer. So I finished my year as the supply officer, which was one of two jobs in the troop that I, in the squadron, that I would not have wanted. In fact, it was number two to the bottom. The only one I wouldn't have wanted was maintenance officer, because I don't know anything about how you maintain tanks and that sort of thing. Yeah. So supply officer I could handle, and did handle, and we went through two typhoons, all sorts of other natural disasters, and yet we never ran out of gas, we never ran out of food, we never ran out of ammunition, because my little team and I would use innovative methods to get the supplies there in spite of the road network being blown away by a hurricane.
What was it like when you returned from Vietnam?
I had no problems whatsoever. I'm a native Alabamian. Since the war and other assignments, I've talked to officers who were there who were spit on at airports, on trains and planes, rocks thrown at them, epithets hurled at them. My mother met me at the airport in Birmingham. I was in my uniform, and it never dawned on me that I should be guarded against some kind of a verbal attack or what have you. Got my bags and we just walked through the airport. And nobody's clapped or saluted as they did for Desert Storm and Afghanistan, folks coming home. But I had never experienced an adverse reaction whatsoever.
Where were you assigned after Vietnam?
I went to the Armor Advanced Course at again back to Fort Knox, Kentucky for 9 months for training for higher level work and so forth. And there were two or three captains in my course who I had known in Vietnam, a couple from other assignments. And so it wasn't over home week, but at least I knew a few, 100 or so of us. And interestingly, they had three classes going on simultaneously. And the one before us had a captain who received an interim Distinguished Service Cross that later was upgraded to a Medal of Honor. One in our class received a Distinguished Service Cross that was upgraded to a Medal of Honor, and one in the third class received the Distinguished Service Cross that was upgraded to a Medal of Honor. So I was surrounded with three future Medal of Honor recipients, although none of them had it when I knew them.
I see. So what was the highest rank you attained?
Major.
Major. Were you ever injured?
Actually, we had an attack one night and by North Vietnamese sappers way up near the DMZ. And as the troop commander, there was firing, grenades going off. And I was running around in the dark. And I had my .45 on and my helmet and my flak vest, and I was running between some tents, and all of a sudden something hit my leg, one of my left leg, that just sent me head over heels. And fortunately nothing, didn't break a bone or anything. And later, when it got, we killed all of the ones that had infiltrated the camp, and when it got daylight and we were licking our wounds, my leg started hurting, and I looked down and my pants leg was cut and there was blood all around it, and I looked and there was a gash or something on my leg, and I didn't want to get it infected, so I went to the medics and they put iodine on it and a bandage, and a few hours later the adjutant came to my tent with some paperwork, and I said, "What are you doing here?" He said, "Well, I just got a list from the medics of those they treated, and your name was on there, so I'm here with the paperwork for you to sign, for you to be awarded the Purple Heart." "Purple Heart for what?" And he said, "You were wounded." I said, "Well, how do I know it was a rifle shot or shrapnel?" And he looked kind of funny and said, "Well, that's not part of the paperwork." And I started arguing with him. I said, "Look, I was running between two tents. I could have tripped over a tent rope." I said, "I don't know whether it was a shot or what." And he said, "That doesn't matter, Captain. You bled. Your pants are obviously torn. You were given medical treatment. You qualify for the Purple Heart." And I said, "Except in my mind." And thinking ahead, I said, "I have a 3-year-old son at home. When he grows to maturity and has a son, can I bounce my grandson on my leg and him say, 'Grandpa, how did you get that medal that's on the purple thing with a heart?' What am I supposed to tell him? I may have tripped over a tent rope." I said, "I'm not signing that paperwork." And that As a moralist, that's probably one of the biggest mistakes I ever made, because we had others who shed blood, and they signed everything that was put in front of them, and they got purple hearts. And I had no idea what getting a purple heart meant in the future. I shed blood, let me say that, but the cause of it to this day, I cannot raise my right hand and swear.
Okay.
It was due to enemy action. We had a chaplain who got there about the time I did. He was out on a training program before he ever got assigned to the unit with an infantry, a bunch of infantrymen, and they were attacked by Viet Cong. And he didn't fire anything, but the two lieutenants were both second lieutenants. They know what to do. So this chaplain was running around saying, no, you need to bring fire over here. You need to do this. And as he was running in the dark, he stepped in a, I don't know if they have gophers, but an animal's hole, and fell and twisted his leg. He had to go get medical, and he got the Purple Heart and retired as a full colonel. And I thought, how can a chaplain, but he would not have been running around in the dark had it not been due to enemy action. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have been running around in the dark had it not been due to enemy action. So looking back, that's my probably biggest regret, is that I didn't sign the paperwork and say, okay, what I did to shed blood was due to enemy action, so I'll take that Purple Heart. But I really don't, that's not one of my greatest regrets in life.
Do you have any regrets about your service?
Not really. I did as much as I could, studying, etc. When I retired, I had two master's degrees that I had gotten through the Army. But the reason I retired as a major, I was never a regular Army officer. I was a reserve officer. And as such, I was never given the assignments, like in operations or what have you, that would have led to lieutenant colonel promotion, which is what 95% of all officers retire as. And after the war, the Army reduced, and first time there was a reduction, I had two children by then and was on ROTC duty and loving it. And it was announced the Army was going to reduce by X number of officers, 1,000. And I called and my name was in the pot because I was a reservist and et cetera. Had been in combat, but had not been a troop commander in combat and all that. So I was a nervous fellow. I was enrolled in my first master's program and received it. And about a year and a half later, the Army had a second reduction. And I was nervous as a goat. Now I had three children. And so I called and said, is my name in the pot? And the officer said, no, it's not. And in my opinion, it was not just my efficiency reports, but the fact that I had the initiative to get a master's degree, and that showed the Army something, so my name was not submitted. And then the third time they had one, I was not submitted either. So I did retire as a major. If some things had been a little different, it probably would have been a lieutenant colonel, but no deep regrets in that regard.
Okay. What words of wisdom would you like to leave for future generations?
Study everything you can. Take advantage of every educational opportunity that you've got. When I retired, I was unemployed. I just retired for 8 months. Retired from Fort Leavenworth, living in Alabama, and got a call asking if I would like to apply for a civilian job back at Fort Leavenworth, and I said yes. And I did, and while there, I earned two more master's degrees. So that didn't get me promoted as a civilian, but it did. I left the Army and left civilian, or when I retired totally. I had two bachelor's degrees and three master's degrees, none of which I paid a dime for. My books were paid for by the Army, my tuition by the Army, etc. And I'm sure that what I learned perhaps helped in whatever job I was given, either as active duty or civilian. So study hard. know the rules, know the regulations, follow them. If you have questions, ask somebody who knows. And I think the best advice I ever got was in my second assignment as a second lieutenant in Korea. And I was in a terrible supply job there that I really hated because I wanted to be a platoon leader in a cavalry troop. And that opportunity came. So I am being shown around my new troop area by my platoon sergeant. He showed me the storage room and unlocked the door, and we went in, and we were alone, so he took that opportunity to give me some fatherly advice, I guess. And he said, "Well, sir," "may I give you some advice as a platoon leader?" I said, "Absolutely, I appreciate that." He said, "Okay." He said, "As the platoon leader, you've got two missions, the welfare of the men and the accomplishment of the mission." And I said, "Yeah, I think that's what they told us in the basic course, so I'm glad to hear you reinforcing that." He said, "No, that's just what the Army, that's the Army way, the law or whatever, not law, the rule." He said, "Take my advice." He said, "You only have to do one of those." I said, "I don't think I understand." He said, "Sir, you take care of your men, and your men are going to take care of that mission." And I've never forgotten that. And I found him to be 100% correct.
Not only for the Army, but for life.
In life, yep. Yes, yes, indeed.
Do you stay in contact with any of the men that you served with?
No, absolutely not. There was one reunion that I heard about. I'd love to go to a reunion. It was going to be in Washington, D.C. in 19 or 20 something. And my wife had already said, "Go." My civilian job at Command General Staff College, I was the protocol officer. And I had to handle all the VIPs who came to visit the college, do their itinerary, etc. And one of my biggest jobs was to brief the guest speaker at the CGSE graduation every June, where 3,000 people came to see their sons and daughters graduate. And they sent me the dates for the reunion, and it was graduation weekend. And I didn't have a backup, so I forgot all that. And I've never heard about I don't know if the CAV squadron having any more since then or what, but I've never heard about one, so no.
What degrees did you earn while you were serving?
My first was an MBA while I was on ROTC duty. When I got there, this was a college in Alabama, university in Alabama, and the colonel called all the new ones in and gave us his philosophy, and he said, "Well, I noticed that you have a bachelor's degree." "Yes, sir, all officers have to have a bachelor's degree." He said, "Well, I want you to get a master's degree. If you've got 3 years here, it takes 2 years to get one." And said, "You decide when you're ready, and you let the executive officer know, and I will see that your teaching schedule is built around your class schedule as a student." And we had a couple of hard heads who didn't take advantage of that, but probably 95% of us took advantage of that and left there with a master's. It was an MBA. And then my second one was while I was at Fort Leavenworth before I retired. The Army had a deal with the journalism school at the University of Kansas for a two-year master's in journalism. And I think I was the only active duty, I was the only faculty person. There were a lot of students who applied for it. I was the only faculty person who did, knowing I was going to retire in 2 years. And so I got a master's in journalism the same year that I retired. And when I came back as a civilian, the Army had made a deal with Kansas State University for a master's in education, since Fort Leavenworth is an educational place. So I signed up for that and became the first faculty member under that program to receive a master's in education.
What veterans organizations do you belong to?
All of them, except the Purple Heart. Life member of the VFW and an annual member of the American Legion. Just joined a new one that's going to raise money to build an armored museum, cavalry museum, called the Combat Armor Decision Museum, I think in Virginia somewhere. I'm a volunteer and a member of the President's Council at the National World War I Museum and Memorial, and a tour guide there in Kansas City. Member of the World War II Museum in New Orleans, which I've not seen, and two or three other historical. I'm a fellow in the Company of Military Historians. It's an international historical organization. There's a local in Kansas City, the Kansas City Military Collectors Club, that I'm in my 10th year as the president of, which is about half the existence of the club. They just won't let me not be the president. We're ready for a break. But we have supported this for about 8 years now. And we've got a large, we've got 28 of the tables upstairs that our club members do. And other local things around Fort Leavenworth that are historical and so forth.
Okay. Anything else that you'd like to share with us?
Before I retired, I was an Army journalist for part of my career and was offered the possibility to be a weekly columnist for the oldest paper in Kansas, the Leavenworth Times. Mm-hmm. And that was 31 years ago, and I accepted it. But before I ever wrote my first column, the general manager called me back in and said he'd changed his mind. I said, "You don't want me?" He said, "No, I want you twice a week instead of once a week." And I'm in my 32nd year as a twice weekly columnist for Leavenworth Times. Never missed a deadline. Was honored at the end of my 30th year, got a big certificate, framed certificate, from both the Kansas House of Representatives and the Kansas State Senators, attesting to my 30 years as a twice weekly. I think I am the longest serving twice weekly columnist, if not in Kansas, in the whole Midwest. But I don't know how to find that out. I don't know who keeps a record or something like that.
Yeah.
It's interesting, a lot of fun, keeps me young. Now I have three grown children, all married, all college graduates, seven grandchildren, two of whom are married, and one 8-month-old great-grandchild.
Quite an accomplishment.
Well, I didn't have much to do with the latter couple of things there, but proud of all of them. But I can't get any of them to come here to see this. They're all playing sports today.
Okay. All right, sir. Well, we do thank you for your service and thank you for taking the time to share your story with us.
Okay.